Hi everyone and welcome to Inside Classics. I'm Ayelet Khamzun-Lushkov, joined as always by Sam Ross and Cassie Winkley. The episode you're about to hear was recorded almost a year ago in summer of 2020, and its publication was delayed for various boring reasons, but we offer it now in the hopes that the anniversary of the pandemic offers a good time for reflection on how things were, how things have been, and what we might still learn from it. We hope you enjoy.
My name is Amy Pistone. I am a professor, assistant professor of classical civilizations at Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. And I work on Greek tragedy primarily, but I'm also sort of a generalist and very interested in equity and pedagogy.
My name is Joanne Galizio. I'm a lecturer at the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. I specialize in Bronze Age archaeology, but more specifically at UT, I work on online pedagogy and developing courses in classics for teaching online.
Hi, my name is Zoe Elise Thomas. I'm a second year PhD student at the University of Texas at Austin in the classics department. And theoretically, my research focuses on spatial theory in the Roman provinces in the imperial period. But I'm kind of all over the place, so.
All right. So my first question is, in kind of pre-pandemic times, what is fundamentally different about an online learning space, and how do you kind of accommodate for that for your students?
Did you all do online teaching in the before times?
I didn't really. I had been doing a lot of work with sort of integrating digital humanities into courses, but my courses had all been predominantly face-to-face. And so I've been thinking a lot about how to pivot and transition classes in the after time, because none of our classes at, I was at Michigan as a grad student and Notre Dame and then Gonzaga, and we don't offer a lot of online classes in any of those departments. So this is sort of, I have been diving in trying to think about how to make the things that we know about pedagogy work well in an entirely online environment, which we may be going to for the foreseeable future, unfortunately.
Is this your first year in Gonzaga?
This is my first year at Gonzaga, yeah. I was at Notre Dame for 2 years as a visiting assistant professor, and this is my hopefully my forever home. This is a tenure track position, so I can start to really make a home at this department.
Yeah, but so this has been quite a start to
I think it's how everyone's dream first year at a new institution goes. halfway through their spring semester, the world turns upside down.
It has
definitely been a challenge, but thankfully we have some really supportive they did a lot to make sure that we had the support we needed, but our classes weren't designed to be online, and so pivoting mid-semester for classes that were designed around in-person face-to-face teaching really presented a kind of a separate set of challenges. But this is my first year. Yay.
Yeah, that deserves like extra double kudos, because when I think about my first year on the job, I think I could barely like manage standing up and talking at the same time. So if I had to pivot, I mean, my pivot this year was so abysmal that if I had to do it while also learning on the job, I don't think I could have hacked it. So you deserve like extra double congratulations for making it through.
Well, thank you.
So Joanne, since you're the expert, should we do you last?
Sure.
You're the expert test. But so then let's just quickly finish this round, and Zoe and Joanne, can you just talk quickly about what your online experience was before?
Yeah. So I'm going to let Joanne go last, because I have done no online pedagogy at UT prior to this semester. This was my first experience teaching an online class, but I actually took several online classes when I was in high school, which was 10 years ago. So presumably online pedagogy has changed in those 10 years, because technology has changed quite a bit.
We'd hope.
But so a lot of my experience prior to this semester was being a high schooler taking online classes at a community college.
Well, and so what was that like taking as a student?
I mean, I loved it. I I got to take classes that weren't, you know, offered at my high school, which was really what was exciting for me. I did have an interesting class that was like biology of the Pacific Northwest, because I'm from Seattle, Washington. And yay! And I had to do self-directed field trips, which was weird. And I've been thinking about that a lot in pandemic times. Obviously, we can't really go outside to necessitate self-directed field trips, but thinking about, you know, looking at online museum collections and having students do kind of self-directed online field trips and things like that. So
in our first episode, we talked to Adam mm-hmm. Rabinowitz about, you know, digs and what happens when they have to shutter. And Adam, to know him is to love his prospecessual obsessions.
Yes.
Obviously, Adam records everything. And so I was curious as to whether he can sort of like 3D print, right, his site and
yeah,
and kind of like, you know, have students have a go at it. And he says we're not quite there yet. We kind of like electronically redig a site. But I kind of think, you know, that's kind of, it must be in some ways
we're getting there.
Yeah, where we're headed.
And we'll get a Republican house at Gabby I. And
yeah. And I know you did some stuff, Zoe, with online games and kind of immersive experience. So we will round back to that.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people have been digging into virtual reality, digging, not intended pun there, but using virtual reality as a way to explore sites that students wouldn't be able to physically go visit right now. But one of our faculty members, Andy Goldman here, he's been doing a lot with virtual reality anyway for his classes. And it's been a really useful way to supplement now that some other things are not available. He's, you know, having that as an option has been really nice. Yeah. So I wonder if we'll see that more with archaeology, you know, sites that are not able to be worked on right now, if we might use some virtual reality modeling.
Yeah. And it might also be an interesting way of thinking about making archaeological sites more accessible for students who can't afford to go, but also for sites that we don't want people to go to because it's dangerous mm-hmm. or because, like Pompeii, it's getting worn down. So having these virtual versions might... Like, it might open up an interesting side hustle, I guess, for...
And there's already a lot of stuff, like, available for free online in association with this. We're actually rebuilding our Intro to Rome course this summer, and I was building a module on the Etruscans. And I found these great virtual tours going right inside Etruscan tombs and the kind of slow pan across the walls, so you can see all these amazing details, and I've embedded them into some of our content in the course to really give students a sense of what visiting one of these tombs would be like.
That is very cool, because I would be too scared to go into one.
Well, and I remember when I was taking, you know, art history classes, and, you know, you're just, I mean, we were looking at the same stuff everyone's always looked at, archaeological reports and sketches of things. But now we have the technology to construct possible sort of like what Arthur Evans did at Knossos, but without damaging the site. And you know, you can reconstruct it in different ways. And students are getting to do these there's sort of some DIY things where like you put your smartphone in a little holder and it's effectively your own virtual reality headset. And they're experiencing sites in ways that I never did. I was seeing pictures of ruins, and for them to be able to see the pictures of ruins, but also see a fully reconstructed thing that they could walk around in and look at things is just a very different level of access than a lot of us had when we were first learning about these sites.
Yeah. So, John, what was, because I know you did do online teaching.
I've done a lot of online teaching. I've taught actually all of the courses, the online courses that our department offers, which includes both large enrollment lecture courses. We currently run a Introduction to Roman Culture class and a Introduction to Mythology course. These are large section courses, usually taught by our graduate student instructors. And we also have two fully online versions of our Latin sequence, our first two semesters of Latin. And we've also developed a hybrid course for our third semester of Latin. And I've been involved in the development and design of all of those classes. And I mean, I think one of the things to take away from these online classes, the actual ones that are designed and meant to be online, is that these courses take a really long time to develop. It's not something that happens overnight. It's something that, you know, can take at least a year of planning just to get it up and running. And then once you start teaching it, there's usually a good year or so of revisions and changes that need to be made, especially since so many of us approach online pedagogy without really a whole lot of background in it. And so there's this element of trial and error. You think you come up with a great assignment that's going to be really collaborative and, you know, really get students involved in the course, and it just falls flat. So then you have to go back to the drawing board and figure out something that's going to be better to try out the next time, or to try out as a different assignment later on in the semester. So it's this always constantly evolving process, just like regular teaching. You know, I don't think any of us teach the same class exactly the same time and exactly the same way every semester. So I think that's one of the things to consider with teaching online. So what we're doing and what we had to do this semester is not, I wouldn't even call it online pedagogy. I would refer to it more as remote instruction, which is very different from what online pedagogy involves.
Yeah, yeah. And Sam and Cassie, before this term, did you take any online courses?
So I had, until this semester, I'd never taken an online course. And then two of my courses this semester were kind of online from the outset. And so one of them was a simultaneous online class. And so that was disrupted by the pandemic. And the other one was a fully online class, with the exception of exams were in person. And so that one has been kind of disrupted less, although there has still been noticeable disruptions. And so I've been able to see those kind of as I was transitioning to online in my other courses and being able to compare them, but I'd never taken an online course before this term.
I hadn't either, and that was on purpose because I'm not self-disciplined. I think I mentioned this in the previous episode we recorded, but I had to homeschool myself for a couple of years in high school, and this wasn't like an online homeschooling thing. Like, I had workbooks and stuff, but just from that experience I knew, like, once I go to college I can't take online courses because I don't have the self-discipline to sit down and like work through the material at a reasonable pace. And what did end up happening with a lot of my classes is exactly what I thought. I wait until the very last minute to, you know, go through all of the materials that had been uploaded online, and then, you know, quickly take the exam on all of my short-term memory. So yeah, no, I hadn't taken online courses.
And Zoe, did you have any seminars this term that got switched to online, or would you just...
Mm-hmm. Both of my classes. I mean, so I was in a pedagogy seminar with Joanne, actually.
What a term to teach that.
I know. So, of course, that switched to being online. Although in most of the disruption didn't come from the teaching. Like, I felt, I mean, Joanne, you can speak from the instructor side, but from the student side, it didn't feel too disrupted in the sense that we just continued to have like Zoom calls instead of our in-person seminars. What got disrupted was our observations and our assignments, where we would go out and, you know, watch other people teach at UT and review assignments and things like that. So that kind of, that aspect got disrupted. And my other class was Dr. Raven Taylor's Bay of Naples seminar that Sam was also in, that we, right, you were in that, Sam. I'm not making that up. Okay, yeah, I was there. We switched to a completely asynchronous model. So we didn't have any in-person seminar time, and it was all discussion board based, which we can talk about kind of the effects of that, and the flexibility that Dr. Taylor built into the class. We can talk about that later, or we can talk about that now. I don't know.
I mean, I went to fully asynchronous because I have two small children, and at any given moment, one or both of them could explode. yeah. But I actually didn't feel like it was the best thing for me or the best thing for my students. And I was very aware of, well, primarily my own limitations, but, you know, that not every student can have reliable internet and, you know, time zones and all the stuff that people have been talking about. And so I didn't want to go synchronous. But for me, the problem was that going asynchronous made it very, like, set it and forget it. Mm-hmm. And that's the worst mode of teaching for me because I forgot it. And, you know, as a result, you know, between, like, getting the course prep ready and the kids and like freaking out about, you know, global health and are we all going to die? Like, I would just drop a lot of balls. It felt very disconnected. At some point, like, I have this hang up where I hate going to class. Like, once I'm in class and I'm teaching, then
okay, I think, right, Sam? It's okay. Yeah. but like the 5 minutes when I have to like make myself get out of my office, stop what I'm doing, get out of my office, walk over there, set up, like I just hate it. And it just somehow the online environment made it 20 times worse. And so I would just resent the whole experience. And it just was a mess. And then on top of that, there was the like, you know, Prama in the other room, like trying to keep Ella from screaming. And at some point we like gave up. And so Ella just, my 3-year-old just sat in with me on a few courses. She gave the students an excellent lecture on coronavirus, you know, so it was just like, yeah, it wasn't a conducive method or a conducive, like it just wasn't set up very well. So I would do like almost everything different next term. But yeah, I mean, I wanted to go asynchronous because I thought it was the appropriate thing to do, but pedagogically, mm-hmm. I don't think it was good for me or for the teacher. And it also made me start, and we can talk about that later or not, that we talk about pedagogy a lot in terms of the students, and we're very student-centered, and we should be, but a class that you can't deliver well is not a good class, however student-centered it is. And so it really kind of, in something I've been thinking a lot for a few years, but it also made me kind of very aware that pedagogy also needs to center the teacher or the instructor, mm-hmm. and work in ways that we can do well and generously. So, you know, this is why it's a bad idea to assign 5 essays to the last week of terms, because you can't grade them, right? So yeah,
I don't think that was specific to you either, Ayala. Like, I have a ton of experience developing online courses, and I had pretty much the same experience that you did. I made the same decisions to go completely asynchronous, mostly for the benefit of my students, because I had no idea what they were going through, and I didn't want them to have to sort of log in at a specific time, and I wanted to make things as equitable as possible. But I felt very disconnected to my students afterward. And I'm not even sure how they feel about the course, you know, after spring break, whether they were enjoying it. Some, you know, a few of them said that they were enjoying the content that I was developing for them. But yeah, it was not the way that I would have done this. And we were dealing with really big question marks before we went online. You know, the plan was for a lot of people to go through Zoom, or a lot of people to use use primarily Canvas. And we had no idea if these were even going to work. Yeah. So I was trying to find other methods in case these things didn't work. And honestly, I think a lot of the professors that just went straight to a Zoom model, I think their experiences were actually better than those of us that tried to go asynchronously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I had irregular Zoom meetings with the students, but because they were optional and they were erratic, it didn't quite, but you know, but it, I did like that. That was what made me think I could have just done a synchronous meeting and used the breakout rooms and whatnot, and it would have felt better. But yeah, there is, I don't know.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sam.
Go.
I was just going to say, I mean, I had a very similar experience in that my classes were really heavily discussion-based. I was teaching a lot of literature classes, and then I was also teaching beginning ancient Greek, and language classes are hard, and there were a lot of things that I just couldn't do. I think Latin might have been easier, but my students never learned to type in Greek keys, because why would they need to? We were doing everything in person, they were writing things down. And so, you know, we did a lot of drilling. Like, they all had their own individual dry erase boards, and they would write, you know, we would say, like, let's change that verb form to the plural, and they would put it on their dry erase. And just a lot of my teaching had been very much designed, because I'd only ever taught in person. A lot of my pedagogy was very much designed around things that were only available sort of in person. You know, we switched and we made things work, and they had a lot fewer tests and quizzes, and you know, the format of things changed. But I think for Greek especially, there are just a lot of limitations around, I didn't think it made sense to, in addition to, we're learning me verbs and I need you to learn how to type in Greek keys and figure out where to put accents and how you add accents to, can you put a neo to subscript? That's a whole day of playing around with Greek keys. And so I think between that and then my other two classes were discussion heavy classes, that in like, I gave students the option, we did synchronous and asynchronous options. So I tried to make both of those available, that they could get their sort of participation by coming to class and talking about things in a Zoom setting, or they could do it online, and they were discussion forums and things. And I don't know, I mean, as you both mentioned, I think I would change a lot of things, because the students who were participating via discussion forums or via reading responses and things, they weren't getting that actual discussion, right? I mean, because so few students were choosing that option, the more options they gave students in the interest of being flexible and letting them do what would work best for them, the less any one option had kind of critical mass to get good discussions going. And I think that hurt. I mean, as one of my classes was an ancient lit survey class that we had amazing in-person discussions. And students mentioned, I did some informal feedback with students and they were saying, you know, I miss our conversations. Like Zoom is okay, but it's not the same. And, you know, that was my feeling too. And there was a lot of, I'm not the biggest victim, obviously, of things that have happened, but there was a real sense of loss about like, this class was really great. And I loved teaching these students, and knowing that we all kind of lost something that would have been part of our semester was, you know, it was a tough experience.
Yeah, no, I was just like, this semester has, I think, been triage for a lot of people, just figuring out, okay, what's going to work and help my students get to where they need to be by the end of term. But I guess looking towards the future, so where lots of universities have already announced a shift to online courses in the fall, and I think we're going to see kind of, at the very least, a larger awareness of this as a kind of thing that we need to actively address in our pedagogy. So I guess going beyond this semester and having to change very quickly on the fly, what kinds of things do we need to be thinking about and do we need to be discussing in order to make an online learning space as effective as an in-person one, if it can be, and how we address that going forwards?
So I'll start just by repeating Joanne's earlier point that even going into fall, it's the end of May. We're recording this on May 24th. I can't set up, you know, a fully like born digital online assignment. Like I can't set up a full on online course in 3 months. And I couldn't do that even under the best conditions. So if I had childcare and, you know, UT actually paid me for the effort and stuff like that. So I think it's important to acknowledge that we'll have more of a run-up time and we'll have experience and we won't be doing it kind of, you know, as an emergency measure, but we're still a long way off from, you know, developing like a full set of like, you know, online courses that you can just switch, you know, you can just pivot to online or you can pivot, like, you know, we're not there. Like even next term, we will still be in simulating in the best way we can a face-to-face course. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, a lot of institutions, we are ostensibly planning to do in-person teaching, but nobody knows, which means, you know, for a lot of us, we're sort of course prepping two courses, right? We're the version of my Greek myth class that happens in person and we can have in-person discussions, and the version that is designed well and thoughtfully online from the start, which is really two very different classes. And especially for grad students or early career people, like I haven't taught a lot of these classes before. It's a new course prep period, which is a lot of work to think about. What are my readings going to be? How do I want to structure this? Teaching any class for the first time is such a process of trial and error. And, you know, I would reorder things next time I teach classes I taught this spring, even aside from the pandemic. And so having kind of that first time class prep plus double prepping in the interest of having an online option available because we don't know yet. And we don't know if we'll try and come back in person and then we'll switch to online again. And so, you know, the number of question marks and things that are up in the air right now, I think is making it really difficult, to your point, plus we have the world is falling apart around us. So we have all those extra pressures on top of that. But I think that's these classes, we can do a lot of work to be better prepared to teach online, which is not what most of our pedagogy training has been for. You know, for most of us, our training is entirely to do with in-person teaching, but it's still going to be a real process of trial and error. And I don't think any of us are going to teach our best classes ever in the fall, because, you know, this is something that we have to adjust to as well.
Yeah. I mean, we're all hoping there's a vaccine in 2021 and, you know, in fall 21, we're back on campus as normal and teaching face-to-face. But I would have thought fall 21 is when like a serious effort at more digital online teaching can be actually made. And until then, we're all just like making it up.
Yeah. I will say this is a shameless plug, but I have been working on setting up, and Joanne, I would love to talk to you some about this also, maybe a separate time, but setting up a online pedagogy kind of reading group, working group over the summer, so that some, you know, people are not doing this all on their own, you know, everyone in their apartments trying to muddle through this on their own, but looking at the actual, you know, there are people like you who specialize in this and have a lot to offer, instead of us thinking that because we fancy ourselves to be pretty good teachers in person, all you do is do that teaching out of camera. It's perfect. It's fine. It's easy. But, you know, thinking about what the actual changes and what the actual that, you know, asynchronous doesn't actually mean just record yourself doing it, like record a Zoom meeting and then make it available. Like that is not a good asynchronous learning option. And so, you know, I think my shameless plug of, if anyone is interested in talking through and workshopping some syllabi and things like that, I'm trying to set something like that up for the summer so that we can maybe do this collectively as a community and try and work on some of these things.
Yeah, I would love to be a part of that. That would be fun.
Yeah, I'll reach out to you.
So just in the interest of getting the most out of Amy that we can before she has to go. So Amy, you mentioned that you do a lot with digital humanities and integrating them into courses like pre-pandemic. So can you talk a little bit about that and what you do, what kind of tools you're using and like?
Yeah. So for a lot of, this is more so for CIV kind of courses as opposed to some of the language courses, but thinking about ways to kind of supplement our in-person, because I had a very traditional pedagogical training of like teach in person, write on the board. How do you arrange things on a whiteboard? Well, but thinking about ways to integrate, you know, a sort of different kind of smaller pieces to supplement that teaching. And so using a lot of, this last semester, I used Padlet a lot for student presentations because they could no longer present to their classmates, especially in an asynchronous format. And so that's a place where it's very easy to sort of, it's essentially a digital wall where you can put sticky notes, kind of is the idea. Right. And so, but that was a really useful way to let students, because I had students do their projects as videos, as different, you know, all different types of formats. And so kind of bringing some of that in, and really I am not skilled enough with technology to do some of the really big overarching things. I have partnered with Hamish Cameron he does some of the more very tech savvy, where people are coding, like developing games that you can get inside of a Greek myth and see how you would make decisions differently, decision trees and things.
Hamish is like a wizard.
I know, he really is. Because I do not have that level of kind of, coding is not really my specialty. And so I've been doing a lot more, you know, and thinking about how we can use Google Forms and, you know, just a lot of the kind of little add-ons to supplement class discussions. So I do a lot of have had students do little short, you know, tell me who you most sympathize with in the scene. And then to kind of sort people and doing group stuff. So I do a lot more kind of supplementing the in-person teaching as opposed to the fully digital kind of projects. Though I do have some students who are wanting to do really big digital projects, and I'm excited to be, I haven't asked them if I can talk about their projects, but I'm excited to be part of some of these bigger kind of fully digital humanities projects.
Cool. And have you gotten to use any of that in the after the pivot, or was it just like, and are you going to try embedding them in your course?
I think I'm going to, because especially, I mean, a lot of my students have so much more, there's a lot of these different platforms that students are very comfortable with, in a way that I have tried in the past to give students kind of specific, because I don't want them to have fully open-ended assignments where they're kind of panicking in terms of do something internet for this assignment. but, you know, giving students a lot more flexibility and giving them some examples of, you know, here's a podcast, here's this, here's that, and allowing students to bring those things in. And that is something that I have already been doing more of. And so using kind of a digital space for Greek classes, we do a lot of, I have them do their kind of culture work outside the class. And so they all picked something they were excited about and talked about those kinds of things. And so I've been using a lot more having students put those projects in some kind of an online space, and they can interact with each other there. And so that's been a really nice way to, I don't like a lot of the Greek textbooks culture treatment. And so being able to put that into a separate place where one semester we were able to get a lot of outside classicists, the students were okay with sharing their work and able to get a lot of outside classicists to be part of those discussions, which was a really good way for them to see my current Greek class. We talked a lot about trafficking and the Sappho papyri and things. And but it's been a really good way for my students to engage with the online world of classics and then bring that into the class and make contacts with other people on Twitter, people, you know, sort of a range. So I think I'm definitely going to be expanding that, especially the more online our lives are becoming. I tried to give students the option to do video text, like reading responses, and no one took me up on. I set up a whole Flipgrid. It was a whole thing and none of my students wanted to do it. I know some classes get this like really robust engagement on Twitter. Their classes are all tweeting with and they're having these whole conversations. And my students don't generally seem interested in that, which is fine. But, you know, it's one of those things I have tried repeatedly and my students just don't really want to do Twitter, which that's their choice.
I did a class and I had them do debates, and it was a Game of Thrones and classics course. And so they were broken up into different, like, you know, Lannisters and Starks and Targaryens. And one of the first things they did in the course was to be like, well, why is classics just Greek and Roman? And I was like, I have no good answer to it other than I don't know anything about, like, classical China, but if you do.
Well, so that was, I was teaching women in antiquity this semester and someone was asking, are we going to be talking about Asia at all? And I was like, well, we could. I have to do some research. That is so far outside my specialty. I will go read some things and I'll get back to you on that question. Yeah.
So to make the debates fun, I had them. So one of them was around Halloween and I was like, extra point if you, you know, come in costume. And I said, okay, well, one, everybody has to be in character and one of the characters has to be like, at least one has to be a historical figure. And because they'd already like strung me up on the whole, like, classics is not just Greek and Rome. I was like, okay, you can do any historical figure that you want. So one team had Marx and one team had Confucius. And it was this like great, like, thing. And when we started doing the debates, I was like, I needed a way to not zone out in the way that you do when just students are talking for like the whole, you know, 90 minutes. And I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to live tweet this. So I'm like, you know, taking notes and live tweeting. And at some point, like the UGS, the university was like, oh, this is great. And so they came and did a feature on the class. So they were like the woman from who did it was there for the Halloween course. And now everybody thinks that I'm like way cooler than I actually am because, you know, someone was on Twitter one time and they're right. So yeah, that was fun. But yeah.
Oh, by the way, I yell at my summer reading that I just bought the other day.
Oh, nice.
Nice. You should read my book.
Almost. Yeah, I definitely want to. Actually.
Yeah, it's almost as good as George Martin and a lot shorter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Zoe, I wanted to ask you, because you were TAing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a TA and an SI last semester.
So what, like, you know, I don't know. I'm not very eloquent. So what was that about? Like, how much of a say did you get into the pivot? And because we at least all had agency in making our own destinies.
Well, so I was a teaching assistant, a TA for Dr. Deborah Beck's Intro to Myth class. And so Dr. Beck is, of course, probably one of the best examples of undergraduate pedagogy in our department.
Yes.
I don't think I'm wrong in saying that.
I was going to say, I'm not in your department, and I know that she's a really wonderful teacher. So her playoffs extends well beyond.
Yeah. And I say that as someone who ostensibly works on Imperial Rome, but is writing their master's thesis on the Iliad with Dr. Beck. So
good for you.
She, you know. And she was actually really great about discussing the transition to being online with me, partially because I was an SI. So I was a supplemental instructor, and it's a program that UT has through the Sanger Learning Center, where I host optional skill workshops, basically, that are kind of like discussion sections in the sense that we work on course material, but we don't do anything new. We basically take what they've learned from the week, and then they pick like a skill set, and I develop a lesson plan, and we practice. So, for example, this semester, the course has an ethics flag, so we talk a lot about how to do an ethical analysis within the context of classical mythology. And so we would do a lot of, you know, let's hash out Medea. And, you know, you've just read Euripides' Medea, let's pull out the plot, let's talk about all the harms that Medea does. And all the harms that are done to Medea, and why, you know, is she ethically justified in the choices she makes and things like that. So I think because I was an SI, well, I think Dr. Beck would have included me anyway, but because I continued that SI work even post online, we worked pretty much in tandem on putting the class online. And we went to an asynchronous model, but we also had synchronous Zoom classes that were optional. And I want to say that worked really well. Because the students who didn't have access to the internet, or, you know, I had students that were, you know, living with their grandparents and taking care of grandparents and stuff like that. So it gave the students the chance to be flexible, but then also the students that really wanted to engage and have discussions and come to class, we still got to do that. And so I think that was really rewarding for me. And from the feedback I've gotten from the students so far, it was rewarding for them. But I will say it was a huge amount of work. I didn't have to do most of that. I did a lot of the, like, admin-y, you know, putting little quizzes. We did clicker quizzes. I don't know if you have ever used iClicker, any of you, but little.
But Deborah is like the whiz of, she yeah. is the mistress of Clicker.
Yeah. They're basically like you put a little question up on the board and then the students, you know, respond, you know, A, B, or C, or whatever. And she uses those in her face-to-face classes as a way to stimulate discussion. And so what she did is we just put those online as, like, participation quizzes. So if you did it, regardless of whether you got the right answers, you get full credit for just doing it. And so that was my job, is I just put all the clicker questions online. And I recorded, you know, I had my own TA lecture that I had to figure out how to put online. So that was interesting. But I mean, it was a lot of work, and I think probably a lot more work than the face-to-face class. And I think part of that is, of course, that you're transitioning to putting it online, and because it's Dr. Beck, she's so passionate about making it worthwhile for the students, while also trying to be really conscientious of the workload she's generating for herself and for me. And I was, you know, I was in a position that I could do that, but if I had had you know, my parents had gotten sick and I'd had to go back to Seattle, right? So I've been thinking a lot about the labor involved in this transition online and the labor that's being asked of educators for the summer or even the upcoming fall on what we're asking, you know, you, Ayelet, or Amy, or Joanne to do.
I'm really glad that you, because I feel like this semester, like I'm pretty, you know, I don't have kids. I have a puppy. That's the extent of my caretaking responsibilities. And so I was very willing to put a lot of me into making sure the students were doing okay, right? Like I had a lot of extra, if you couldn't make Greek class, let's set up all, you know, I was giving the same Greek class 4 times a day sometimes, you know, because I wanted the students, if they wanted to have an in-person instruction, I wanted them to be able to have that. And
yeah,
you know, giving students a lot, like it's a lot of work. And it was something that I was happy to do because I knew a lot of my students were struggling, and I was willing to, like, I wanted to be able to do that, but it's not sustainable long-term. I mean, I slept a lot the week after the semester was over. I just really was very drained. Like I was out of energy and enthusiasm and all of that stuff. And I think this was an emergency situation that we were all reacting to. And I was able to do more of that, but not, you know, if my family had gotten sick, if my partner had gotten sick,
yeah,
you know, there are a million situations where like that is not a fair thing to expect every instructor to do and to be able to do, especially right. as, you know, we know the mental health toll this is taking on grad students don't always have funding that they know what's going to happen. You know, faculty don't know, you know, there's just, I mean, in the midst of a legitimate mental health strain on everyone, you know, that is not a sustainable long-term thing. And I'm glad you mentioned kind of the labor, because that's something I have also been thinking about a lot in terms of some of these things worked because teachers at all levels were willing to put their lessons on TikTok and do this and do yeah. that. And that's not fair to ask forever.
So, and this will become especially difficult, especially for someone in your position that's pre-tenure. And especially if you're at like a research institute, you know, you're expected to be spending your summers working on your research. And most faculty, whether they're tenured or not, are going to have to be focusing their efforts this summer on figuring out how to teach their classes in the fall. So they're going to lose a whole summer of research that they're going to need and be evaluated on, you know, as their tenure approaches, or as their, you know, post-tenure review process approaches. And you'd like to think that, you know, administration would be understanding when they did come up for reviews that they weren't able to get as much work done, you know, during the coronavirus because they were dedicating their time to teaching. But there's no guarantee that that's the case. So what should someone in your position do? Should you be working on your research because that's what's going to get you tenure, as opposed to all this effort you're putting into your teaching, which is always considered kind of a lower priority for tenured faculty? And, you know, but you get penalized yeah. for being a more dedicated teacher because you want your classes to be good. But
well, and one of the really, like, I'm really fortunate in that Gonzaga is a very my tenure evaluation, there is less of a research focus and more of a teaching. Like, it is, the balance is different here than it is at some institutions. This is not an R1, which is really has given me such a you know, be able to take a sigh of relief, and because I can, there is institutional support for us kind of pouring ourselves into the teaching right now. But I know, especially for a lot of junior, you know, people who landed a rare tenure track position at an R1, where their ability to turn that into an actual secure job depends on their ability to write that book in the middle of all of this. And so yeah. I am in a much better position to be thinking about these kinds of things than people who just started at UT or just started at Michigan yeah. or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know what the answer is, because I have not had to weigh those questions. The research demand for tenure here is a lot lower than at an R1.
Yeah, and I don't have to deal with those issues either, because I'm a lecturer and my lecturer specialty is teaching. So I'm just going to be spending my summer doing what I would, well, actually not what doing what I'm an archaeologist too. So I was supposed to be in Greece this summer doing archaeology work, but instead I will be designing online classes in Texas.
Which is almost the same as the summer in Greece. Yeah.
Yeah. I will say, I mean, speaking of loss that kind of came up earlier, a lot of the archaeology grad students have been put in a weird position of, in order to further our research career, we need to be abroad. We need to be digging. We need to be pursuing our potential specialities in excavation. So continuing osteology. But also a lot of PhD students who have lost access to the archives that they need to have. Or, you know, some of us are lucky we have our research materials here in Austin, but or losing access to the labs that we usually use and things like that. So it's put a lot of graduate students in weird research positions.
Yeah, and too. The libraries are not as accessible. We don't really, I don't think anyone in our department needs archival access, but, you know, archives are not accessible. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it is definitely, I mean, there is a sense in which it's almost a relief, right? I imagine a lot of people will say, oh, well, you know, screw research, like, I will answer the call. I will, like, especially women.
Yeah.
And be like, let me hold space for everybody else's frustrations and like needs, and pour themselves into teaching and service and figuring out ways of making campus life better next term, because kind of everything else is by necessity put on hold. So it's like you've been giving a massive permission slip to like
not do your work, right? And teaching does expand to fill the volume you give it. And so it is like, it is difficult to see where research happens. And we all have our like particular issues. Like I haven't had more than like 10 uninterrupted minutes in weeks, but it is a kind of, you know, teaching can be, I mean, low hanging fruit. I don't mean to imply that it's unimportant, but I mean, I think Zoe, you were saying that you were uploading like Clicker quizzes, right? And there is a sense in which, right, you're like, you know, I like 6 quizzes needed to be uploaded and I've done them and like, you know, I didn't need to think about it. And I, you know, just like doing it makes you feel like you've done work, but you also like.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, I mean, and that I think the admin work is really rewarding because I feel like so much of what the pandemic has caused, even more so than I think academia overall causes, is this idea of like, you're just spinning in place. Like,
yeah.
There's, you know, I get to write my master's thesis using like the 10 books I happen to have out from the library and like, we'll just see how that goes. Like the sense of actually finishing a project is even more so, even more nebulous than it used to be. And being able to do those 6 Clicker quizzes is like, yes. I have achieved productivity. Like
I had a thing and I did it and I can check it off.
It's exactly.
Very satisfying.
And you don't have to think for doing it. I mean, like I didn't write the Clicker questions, so I just got to type them in.
But how many of us have gone down the rabbit hole of coming up with cool and exciting questions when, you know, we knew we had an article to finish. And, you know, because teaching is social. So you're like, when you're sat at home and you haven't seen anyone in ages, then, you know, Zooming with your students is exciting. But
And I think there's also, I mean, emotionally, I get a lot more, not to say that I don't find emotional fulfillment in doing research, because I do, because I'm in graduate school, but you get much more immediate feedback from teaching. And I think that's been hard for people in asynchronous models. Like you don't get the visual feedback of what your students are resonating with, but also just from like a, I mean, from a feedback point of view, you know, we can send out informal feedback reviews to students and get immediate, you know, ideally in a perfect world, it's all positive feedback, but you can get immediate input on what's happening and how things are going. And that feels good.
Yeah.
And that's really rewarding in a way that, you know, I can send a draft off to my committee or whatever, but it's, I mean, everyone is busy. They're not going to get around to it. And so anyway, I think it's, of course I love teaching, but it's very easy to get sucked into that like immediate gratification.
Yeah. And especially if you're not, I think, necessarily going to be rewarded for teaching, it really plays into like all your socialization as a woman to just like, you know, make the perfect online class for the fall and then, you know, ignore your student evaluations that say, you know, she really should have brushed her hair before like going online.
My favorite eval is not from online, but it's from last year when a student said that they thought I was strange for picking up a bug and like moving it out of the classroom. They're like, that was just really weird. And I was like, I mean, yes, but
the things that show up on eval sometimes, like things that I remember in a Greek, it was like an intro to Greek civ course, and someone asked a question about the translation, and I was like, I truly have no idea what they meant by that word. Let me go look at the Greek. Give me a second. And I pulled it up on the screen because that was the only computer I had handy. It was the one we were using for the projector, and students saw like the Greek text, and several students. I mean, that was like the thing they talked about in their evals. And especially in grad, they were like, it was so cool. Like it was in this other language and she could just read it. Like, okay. I mean, the things that show up in eval, like, you know, in grad school, 95% of your time is just surrounded by other people who are, it's, I'm not reading enough Greek, not like, oh my God, I can read Greek. You know, it's just a very different perspective on something you took for granted. And it showed up in multiple evals. I thought, huh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry to derail us on the course eval.
Did you guys see that? Well, I mean, it's early, right? But have any of you seen evaluations for this term?
I don't think we can view them until June 4th here. I'm actually really worried because that's going to be going into my promotion materials this semester. Yeah. And one of the biggest problems I've always had with the online classes that I've taught are the course evals are really, really low percentage of students fill them out. And of course, we had to do all of our evaluations this time online. And I mean, I'm talking really low, like under 25% of the class actually completes them. Okay. And when they do, you know, of that 25%, maybe a handful might actually write a written comment as opposed to just checking bubbles. And so that's one of the really big downsides of online pedagogy is the course evaluation feedback is really not a good sampling, and it's usually not very helpful, unfortunately.
I have always preferred online evaluations because one term I actually forgot to do my evaluation.
I do get angry at the end of the semester that I have to give up 20 minutes of a class for course evals, and so I always want to do them online, but I also know that the results are never satisfying.
Ours are done entirely online for in-person classes.
Interesting.
They're all done entirely. And I don't think I've ever been at an institution that did them like on paper or something. So I don't know any other way. But I would say to that, because whenever my partner gets back from walking the dog, I'm going to have to go. So I may have to duck out at some point. But I found that my student evals really recognized the amount, like they recognized the work that went into making online work, which was really gratifying to hear because, you know, we all talked about it was a lot of work. Yeah. And, you know, it really meant a lot at the end of the semester when I was really kind of running on fumes. I felt like it meant a lot to see how many students were like, she gave us so many different ways to make this class work. And that really helped. Like that meant a lot because I was struggling with things. And so I found the evals to be more, I don't know, sort of more appreciative and more compassionate. And I know there's a lot of problems with course evals and the fact that a lot of this language was it is the kind of very gendered, you know, that I was taking care of them in the kind of, you know, the kind of female professors are very often expected to do the work of a mom plus a teacher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know all of those problems, but it was really nice to see in those evals that students did see and appreciate at least the attempt to make the online classes work. I would not say that it was perfect by any means, but for a lot of students having the option of an in-person, like that was their one time that they were getting to have, that it was giving structure to an otherwise timeless void of space that everyone is in now. And it was, you know, it was a chance for them just to kind of have, it felt like life was normal again for a little bit in some ways. And that was something that was really meaningful to see because, you know, I went back and forth on, do I go fully asynchronous? Do I try and do both? Do this and that? And knowing that some of my students, I had them do a lot of journals just for every week for my Greek students of, you know, tell me what you did and didn't get to, but also just how you doing? Like how's life going? And that was a place where I had a lot of students say like, it is so, I really appreciate having a place where we can come. It was this sort of small group of, I started calling them my Amazons. It was an all women class. There was like really a camaraderie and a good bond between the students and them being able to more or less, most of them would be able to see each other a couple times a week was something I think that really gave some structure and social something to students when they needed it. So yeah, I don't know that everyone's experiences are going to be the same. I teach at a much smaller institution. So I think the individual, like, please fill out your evals goes a little further. I had much higher completion rates than I did at like Michigan, which is a more comparable school to Texas. But
Sam and Cass, you're in a position to, because so we have, obviously UT is massive, but because we are in a small department, at least the sales pitch I always give prospective majors is, you know, we're basically such a small department that you're getting a liberal arts college vibe in, right, a big state institution. But, right, there's like a group of majors that moves together from, I mean, not deliberately, but right, you end up being in classes with a lot of the same people. And,
definitely.
And yeah, once you start teaching the major, suddenly, like, I had two courses one term with all of the majors, and suddenly, like, every time I walked down the hall, I knew everybody, and I was so freaked out by this that I just hid in my office. But so what's your guys, like, as writers of evals, what's your perspective on this?
Well, I think, because it's such a small department and because I know a lot of the faculty better than I might if it were a larger class size, I think I also realized, like, oh, evals actually matter. And I think the student perspective on them as a whole is that, like, if you were to sample a random student from UT off of Speedway, is that, like, oh, is this some sort of bureaucratic hoop that, like, doesn't mean anything to anyone? And so I think a lot of students see it almost as busy work, even though it requires very little work. But whereas I think I'm always careful to add things in the comments and kind of give genuine feedback. But that's, I think, also because I have spoken to faculty and about evaluations. So
similarly, I tend to give, well, at least this semester, especially with all the evals being online, I gave priority to my classics professors. And I did end up forgetting one of my other professors outside the department. I'm real sorry. She's tenured. It's fine. but but yeah, no, like I do tend to be more meaningful with my commentary with my classics professors. Like, and I do tend to want to point out the things that I really enjoyed that I thought they did well, but then also like try to actually say maybe, you know, this one little area could have been done a little bit differently. It would have been a little bit better if you had done this instead. So, you know, that it's like meaningful to read these evals because I care about our department and I care about our professors because I really get the sense that they care about me because we are so small and so tight knit. And I really want to give back, I guess, to the department for, you know, supporting me and caring for me.
Yeah, those are always the really most helpful evals that we get. But I actually specifically ask my students to tell me what they didn't like and how I could make it better. And of course, not all of them do. Most of them are just like, woohoo, we're getting out of class 20 minutes early. And they just like, blah, 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 and then run out the room. But those I always do. And I encourage them. I say, look, I'm going to teach this class again at some point in my life. And I would like it to be better. Like, tell me what can be better about it. What would make this, would have made this a better experience for you. So glad you do that, Cassie.
Yeah, I guess I am guilty of skewing my evals. I'm like, I like this person. Oh, is this good course? I'm going to say very.
I do have to admit, I might have fibbed a little bit on Alex Walthall's. I told him his drawings were good, and I wanted him to feel confident in himself so that he would keep drawing.
Except now you're telling on a podcast. This. Yeah, I'm getting the impression his drawings.
He knows. This will probably be a surprise to him.
You guys too sometimes.
One time he tried to draw a diagram of how a loom works, and
why would you ever try and draw that? If I got loom in Pictionary, I just sit down and give up.
I think he's just a glutton for punishment. But yeah. We shared this classroom with my later Greek class, and you know, at the start of Greek class later in the day, it was still up on the blackboard, and Professor Paula Perlman walks in the room and she looks at it and she's like, what kind of diagram, like strange apparatus is this? And I was like, oh, it's a loom. Dr. Walthall drew that. And then she's like, oh, okay. And then just like went on.
Yeah, no, this will probably get cut from the podcast, but I think my favorite drawing of his was my very first graduate seminar I took was one he taught on numismatics, and he just drew a circle and just labeled it coin. And then he meant to like come back later and be like, this is this part and this is, and he just didn't.
And never got it. Yeah. Just coin. They're usually circly. It's good.
I mean, to bring this back into online pedagogy, something right, that was
also, you go, Zoe.
Well, something it's also Dr. Walthall related, but something that I think is really hard with transitioning from an in-person class to an online class, and something that Amy kind of mentioned earlier with like your little personal whiteboards, is losing the physicality of teaching. Something, I mean, you can see my hands vibrating back here, but there's a lot of, I think, physical actions that we do when we teach that we want to emphasize this. So we point at it, or we want to draw a circle on the board and call it a coin. And that's really hard to translate to an online environment. You know, there's ways that you can do it. Like when I did my TA lecture, we used Panopto. So it would like record your PowerPoint and you, and then have little captions and stuff. PowerPoint has like a digital laser point, so you can use that to like frantically circle things on your screen, but it's not the same. It's not the same. Yeah. And Dr. Waltha like tried to demonstrate to my students last semester how to approach a Greek temple versus a Roman temple by walking into a table repeatedly. And that's something that doesn't translate to an online class. I mean, I don't think my students understood what he was trying to do because he was just walking into a table.
But what was he trying to do?
He was trying to show, you know, that a Greek temple, you can approach it from all sides, whereas a Roman temple, you can only walk up the front.
Yeah.
But they remember him doing that, and they remember that interaction and how funny it was. And a lot of that physicality doesn't translate into an online class the same way. And I found that really hard. Like doing SI stuff, the supplemental instructions, I actually use Padlet a lot because I felt like I could kind of approach that idea of we're all contributing in some method to a central visual medium. But in SI, we do a lot of like, we move around, there's a lot of individual group work, we put, you know, students walk up and put things on the board. And it's really hard to put that in an online environment. And I'd love to hear, Amy, about how you manage that with your face-to-face classes.
Not as well as I wish I could have. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, unfortunately. But I will say using a tablet for my Greek class was nice because I could very easily switch over to the whiteboard function. And so still having that ability to impromptu write things on the board. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I think that's something, especially in Greek, that's something that's really important to when students have a question or they mistranslate something, or if I want to say like, okay, now let's make it passive or whatever, the ability to kind of on the fly write things on a board. I know some people put an actual whiteboard in behind them so they could write things on the board. I think one of the things that I loved about my, one of my literature courses was that we did a lot of, you know, group discussion and then come back to the whole, you know, so kind of dig into the text we were reading. And we had this like really dynamic crosstalk sort of that like someone would overhear someone in a different group and kind of yell across the room at, you know, that reminds me of a thing. Remember that, what, you know, whatever it was. And that's something that I feel like was just like the group dynamics are very different in a Zoom setting, in a virtual setting. And, you know, people who, I can't walk around a classroom. Normally I would sort of stroll and weirdly eavesdrop on people's conversations. And, you know, if people had questions or there were things I wanted to nudge or give them like, here's a different question, it seems like you've exhausted that one. And some of that dynamicness is just lost. And I don't know exactly what the answer to that is. I wouldn't say that I came up with a great answer. You know, I did a lot of breakout rooms, but there's something very different about the professor suddenly showing up as a big square in your breakout room, as opposed to the professor like sipping her coffee, strolling around the room. And it's just a very different impact that it has on the conversations that students are having. Like I would jump into things and they'd be having some like very animated discussion and then it would get kind of quiet because now I was listening. And I don't know what the best option for that is, because I don't know if there's a way to recreate that kind of really engaged dynamic conversations that you can have in person. And I think that's it. I was hoping to have a more hopeful thing to end on about maybe we could try X, but I actually don't have any ideas just yet about that. And that might be something that looks different and it's, you know, it's not going to be the same. And maybe we have something that is good in a different way that replaces it. But I don't know if there's a way to capture that in an online space.
Yeah. I don't know that
I have noticed. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Sam.
No, I obviously don't have any answers either, but like that's one of the biggest things that I noticed in the shift to online is the absence of those, I don't know what to call them, like micro moments kind of things where like the classes that kind of turned to a discussion board. So we mentioned the Bay of Naples seminar that Zoe and I were both in, and I thought that kind of we were still able to have substantive kind of engaged discussion there, but every post was this kind of monolithic 10 paragraph thing, occasionally broken up by Zoe's memes, but
I'm reliable.
You have a brand and you
so, but bullying it made it, like, and memes hard to kind of engage with. Like it's not, you can't just kind of make a comment or kind of build a discussion together. It's one person talking and then me kind of responding, and it has a very different kind of dynamic. The the types of things you get out of that are, I think, very different. And so, yeah, I have no answer either. But
it's always one of my big complaints about why I don't think we should think Plato Symposium is a very realistic representation of any kind of party, because like no in-person engagement is like someone monologues for 15 minutes and then we change to the next person. And I think, like you said, you know, that like I wrote 5 paragraphs on how I feel about what Pliny has to say about a thing or whatever, and then someone else like that, you know, we actually in person engagements, it's small bites, right? Someone says a little bit of something and someone else goes, oh my God, yeah, I know that one thing. And
and you lose that ability to kind of move kind of topics and relate things in a more seamless manner. If you write 5 paragraphs on Pliny, then my response is going to focus on this thing that Pliny said instead of kind of a conversation match naturally digressing and moving back and forth. And so in some ways the conversation can be more focused, which is sometimes a good thing. But on the other hand, it's more focused and you cover less and you get less out of it. So,
I mean, I really enjoyed them because I got to go on my deep dives about like agricultural economy in ancient Rome and do a bunch of math, which no one wanted in class. But I was like, discussion board, I can do this and you have to sit through it. So,
but the one thing my students actually did with the discussion boards where we got actual like robust engagement was I set up like a channel for fun and whimsy, and I imagined it being mostly pictures of people's pets, but it was a place where people would follow up on like random things. And we talked about, most of my students are not familiar with Hot Dish. This was during the presidential primary. We had a conversation about Hot Dish, because Amy Klobuchar had her recipe. It's like a tater tot casserole kind of thing that is very popular in the upper Midwest. And one of my students did like a play-by-play, like he found the recipe for her hot dish and he made, because I was like, guys, like hot dish is a, like, you should try it. You're giving me looks when I describe it, but you should try it. And he did like a play-by-play of him making hot dish with pictures. And so it was, I will say that was a really delightful, the students that took advantage of that like whimsy channel. I did get a lot of pictures of pets, but also there were, you know, some of the weird digressions we would go on in class did find a home online, which was nice to see.
Well, and teaching is all about the weird digressions in class. I feel like
for my literature classes, I would have, if anything, I would have like a PowerPoint that I could play if we wanted to talk about, you know, and sometimes in class, if I want to say, you know, here's a map, here's where Sappho was from, here's what, you know, some background context for the literature we were reading. But I would also regularly go on like wild tangents on the board, which did also come up in evals of, her digressions are interesting, but there's a lot of them. And I feel like sometimes we don't get to the things we wanted to get to because she's on a digression. That is fair. But, you know, not that was one of the places where not having that ability to get to use the board in it, you know, if I hadn't prepared something, it was very hard to, you know, I could share my screen and put something up, but there wasn't that same ability to, you know, someone mentioned this thing that Aristotle said. Okay, guys, like now let's just talk quickly about Aristotle's theory of tragedy. Let's do it real fast on the board. And losing that ability to impromptu write things up. Like I can talk off the cuff, but you know, not pedagogy. Yeah. And I mean, it is bad pedagogy to just throw Greek things at students. But you know, and I had a lot of students who love doing like mind maps with students next to them. And so I think, Zoe, to your point, that physicality and there's things that maybe we'll come up with ways to replicate some of that as we think more and talk to people who, you know, spend a lot more time thinking about these questions. But I think it's going to look different. And it's not a major loss and grief, but it is something of saying like, okay, some of the things that I love about teaching aren't going to look the same. And I need to come to terms with that. And I think that's going to be a process over the summer while we're also prepping to put all of our classes into online formats. There's going to be this idea of like, I'm going to have to give some things up that I was really excited about doing with this class and I'm not going to be able to do it. And it's okay, but it's not what I wanted. And, you know, I think it's going to be important to give ourselves a little bit of room for the low grade things that we wanted to happen that aren't going to happen.
Well, they actually, like, they take up quite a lot of teaching time. Like I was recording my PowerPoint presentations and I mean, I was doing it quickly because I wanted to like save on bandwidth. And also like I had right X amount of time before someone burst into the room. But I noticed that when I was just talking to myself, I got through a lecture in like 30, 45 minutes, which in the room, I would normally have like gone over time. Like I took, I think, a week and a half to do Herodotus 1. And maybe 40 minutes to talk about Tacitus, and like, I do Roman historiography, I have more to say about Tacitus, but you're not in the room and you're just talking to yourself and it's exhausting, and I would just like start yawning like in the middle of any of my online lectures just because it's tiring, and you don't have that like, you know, digressive, you know, here's Megara, let me tell you about a random thing that happened to me in graduate school. When,
you know. Right. Let me try and draw a map of where this is on the fly. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
And you also don't get the students asking questions in the moment. I mean, the students always surprise me with whenever I do like a TA lecture, the kind of questions that they have about the materials, of course, aren't things that I think that they'll have questions about. And it, you know, sends the class off in a whole new direction. And for me as a student, those are always the moments that I remember the most.
I think the having student dynamic, I don't know how to phrase this exactly, but like dynamic student contributions to where the class goes that day.
Yeah.
You know, when you're doing it asynchronously, the class goes where you make it go because you are recording a thing and that's very different than here are some ideas I have that I wanted to talk about with Tacitus, but then student questions are going to take us in very different, you know, students see things in some of these texts that I just wouldn't think to ask a question or wouldn't think to discuss. And when they ask it, I mean, our class can go in a very different direction. And I think that is also something that you lose with an asynchronous format is you can't have students guide where the class is going to go. It goes where you preset it to go. There is a path and they walk on that path. And that's not, I think for a lot of us, you know, we would prefer classes not to run that way.
So I know you have to go soon, but before you go, I want to ask about one thing that we have all gained from online teaching, which is your set of excellent costumes too.
Yes!
which I would like to hear more about, because I did it in my tatty t-shirts. I think one time actually in pajamas.
I mean, for the parts that are not on camera are rarely, unless I need to do, you know, I want to do some kind of fun, like taking pictures of a full body costume situation. But I really like dressing up for things. There has never been a themed costume party that I haven't decided to go very, very themed for. And the Women's Classical Caucus at the SCS every year, LCC-WCC party where I start thinking about that somewhere around September of, guys, what are we doing for our costume? Who can bring face paint? Like, who's going to be able to transport things to the place that we're all going to be in for this? And when I was moving, I couldn't bring myself to get rid of most of my costumes that have stuck around from Halloweens and costume parties and things over the years. And it turned out to be, I had no idea that this was the moment that all my costumes were waiting for, but... It was kind of fun. And that was another thing, actually, some of my students, like, they were really super excited about, like, oh man, you know, this week is going to be, you know, I mean, some of the Hawaiian shirt day, or we did classical hair day, and some of my students like got so into it. And I think from a bigger picture perspective, it was fun for everyone to get, you know, everyone got to see, and they would take selfies and send me their selfies of them with their costume or their hair or their this or their that. But yeah, also I think just kind of it added some fun to what it's not a very fun time right now, and everyone is stuck in their houses. And it was nice to, I would say some of my classes, we did devolve at times into people would bring like the weirdest thing they have in their room, and we would have like a quick show and tell at the beginning of class. But I don't know. It was really nice to have places where students' kind of individuality and lives outside the class could still come into the class, because they would do that before class all the time. And Zoom, you don't do that. But it was really nice to get to dig through lots of costumes and revisit a lot of... there were a couple that I didn't actually even use. I had some Star Wars ones that I didn't use, and I have a Ghostbusters complete with the wig. It was specifically Kate McKinnon from the Lady Ghostbusters reboot costume. It was not just any Ghostbusters. This was Kate McKinnon in Lady Ghostbusters. there were a handful. I have a Statue of Liberty costume that I haven't... 1 year for Halloween, I dressed as the... it was when there was one of the big government shutdowns, and I was the Statue of Liberty with a closed due to shutdown sign for Halloween that year. So yeah, I love a good chance to dress up, and that is a nice thing about being on these... Also, it distracts from... it's so hard not to look at your hair and your face and things. And so I feel like being in costume as someone who works on drama, I'm like, now I am in a role. I don't need to fuss with what my hair is doing and what everything else is going. I am now in a role and I shall take on my persona.
And what was the most popular costume?
Or
the one that the student resonated?
I think that Harry Potter is really at that nice intersection. I think that was probably the one that we had the most students. I really loved the classical hair, just because one of my students recreated like a specific statue and it was so impressed with her work.
You shared that on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing. It's incredible.
The things that I got permission from her yesterday to share some of her other work. She is amazing. She also, because she did not actually sew her hair, but I was like, you know, if you would like to, like, I'm fair game, you can. So once we are allowed to be in person again, she is going to try some of the actual sewing techniques. And I was like, you know, I don't care if you do something to my hair. I have plenty of it. We'll cut the parts out that are bad and we'll keep moving. She used to do like gem work. Like, she is a one woman artisan craft fair, the skills that she has. And I think she fenced at one point, and she can make everything. She's like a really skilled sewist, and it's crazy. So she is, whenever I have weird questions about things, like, does anyone, she would know how an ancient loom worked. There's no question. She could demonstrate and talk about her personal experience as a recreating ancient loom practices person.
Well, if we get our act together enough to have notes to the podcast, then we'll ask you for links.
Absolutely. So, this is my dream at one point. I have a lot of students who are extremely crafty and like good at crafts, not that they're like wily and tricky. Ooh, like they're not Odyssean. They are very good at crafting. We talked about potentially having like a practicum course where the Pacific Northwest has a lot of kind of hipster artisan-y kind of things. And so getting people of like, okay, we read a lot about bees. Let's go out and like, let's find some bees. And we actually have bees when they redid to help pollinate stuff on campus. There's actually a bee population that is on the roof of one of our student buildings. And so I'm like, this would be, we'll do bees. And one of my students is really good at pottery. I'm like, let's do like authentic, like let's find out what we can about the actual technologies they use. She does a lot of hand-thrown stuff. I'm like, this is great. We could do a whole practicum of let's recreate like experimental archaeology. And that is a dream of mine that we will be able to get students out there. Like, let's figure out how did they make wine? Let's make some wine. Let's make some pottery. Let's learn about red figure, black figure. Like, let's try it out. Let's see how the techniques work. So stay tuned. Maybe one day.
Yeah. My freshman year, we 3D printed a Kylix from the British Museum's collection. And then someone in the class was a potter. And so she threw one, and then we kind of went outside on a weekend and like tried to figure out how to play Katabas.
I have had such plans to try and get some Katabas, and I have given papers on how I think the Skolion game would have worked in practice, and cause I think it's more elaborate than the, I think Athenaeus doesn't necessarily give us a full enough picture of what, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I have dreams of, at the Canadian, what is it, Classical Association of Canada meeting, the big meeting for Canada for classics, we were going to have, like, there was going to be this whole symposium thing this year, and people were going to, you know, do ancient drinks and recipes, and people who've made ancient beer, and there was going to be a whole symposium thing, and I was going to try and get people to try and do the drinking games the way I think they would have been played to, like, test them out, and it is one of the many great regrets of... The conference will be next year, and so maybe by this time next year I will have proof of whether or not my theories are any good.
Yeah, I have faith there's always going to be an audience for that type of activity.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that is very true.
I have forced my friends to play Katabas with me. Not authentic, but very fun.
Sam is a very tolerant like lady, sober, isn't she?
How do you recreate the drag?
All over myself.
We just used like wine and then added little, you know, like dirt to it because we're out
put some
shots
in it.
So yeah, we like, you know, drank most of the wine and then had little plates, like little curved plates that we found and put some junk in it. I was actually very good at it.
Right.
We will one day when we can all see each other in person again, we shall at an SCS, we'll find a big open space where we can make a mess and try this out.
Yeah. In the presidential panel, I feel is the Yeah. So I think we're going to need to start wrapping up because I am getting word that Theo is losing his shit. But
I should. My partner and the dog are back. So I should probably duck out for soon as well. So, but yeah, should we wrap up in some official.
So what I wanted to ask, and Amy, if you need to duck out, then do. And thank you so much for joining us. And
no, it's I've got a few minutes. We're good.
But what I wanted to get is sort of some practical stuff, right? So what should we be thinking about, and what should we be doing as we think about it over the summer? And I know Joanne has a ton of kind of practical advice, but actually I want to start with Zoe because a lot of us will be planning for courses with TAs. So Zoe, how do we make our TAs' lives better and easier? And what should we be taking into account? If you want to think about it, then we can make Joanne go first.
No, I can go. I mean, I think honestly, just, I mean, I think it's probably the same for in-person classes as just communicating with the TAs to figure out. Dr. Beck was really good about being like, here's what I would like you to do. How much of this can you actually do? / would you enjoy doing it? Just being really open and upfront with your TAs about, you know, here's what I'm planning on trying to do. I understand that these are unprecedented times and we're in the middle of a global pandemic. And like, how are you doing? And is it okay if I ask this amount of work for you or this type of work from you? Is it something you're comfortable doing? Because I think, I mean, I struggled a lot with after the transition to staying home. Turns out it's really bad for mental health. And who knew? And just the act of working with a professor who is very open to hearing, like, okay, so this week you're just, how are you feeling? You're feeling bad. Okay, do what you can. Just the act of having that support makes me more productive, right? Like, even if I'm feeling really bad, knowing that the professor has my back makes me a lot more comfortable and able to do more work or, you know, more thorough work or things like that. And then also, I don't know, encouraging creativity. It was really fun to put together my TA lecture. I talked about, like, the Parthenon marbles and ethics of museums, and the online pandemic kind of facilitated a different kind of creativity with the materials. So,
and you made those amazing, like, checklists for your students. Like.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually was inspired by Anna, one of the other PhD students at UT, from her online checklist that she made for her students for her online Latin class, I believe, of like a weekly checklist. And it's super beautiful, but that's because I used Canva, which is a free online thing.
I did that too for my checklist for students.
Right. They look so nice. And take no effort whatsoever.
They look so much fancier than the amount of work I had to put into them.
Right. So, and I found that really, I mean, and that's partly because I like creative things and I like creative projects and I like making things pretty. So that's something that I found really fun as a TA, but of course not every TA is going to really, that's not going to speak to every TA. it's not going to spark joy. But my students really appreciated those checklists of like, ooh, here, you know, because like Cassie was saying, I don't know if it was this call. We've got multiple attempts at Zoom calls. Cassie was saying that she was like, I can't take online classes because I won't create a structure for myself. And that was feedback I got back from the students of like this weekly checklist, even though it wasn't real, like there were no real, you know, deadlines. But the simple act of having a checklist that I looked at and was like, ah, okay, I should have this done by this day, helped them facilitate that sort of accountability, which can be otherwise extremely difficult in an online class, regardless of pandemic or not. So,
yeah, I will say that when it came to my thesis, I did make a checklist for myself because I prioritized that above everything. And while it worked for a little bit, I did kind of fall off of it. As Joanne knows, for about 2 weeks, I got like
got
way
it done.
I got it done though.
But the check,
if I had known it, I'm looking at this website right now. These checklists are like crazy pretty. I wish I had known about this sooner because it kind of might have encouraged me a little better than my little notepad checklist that I did make. But yeah, the whole checklist idea, it's a great idea.
Well, and I think there's also something different to having your supervisor make that checklist for you, right? So it's one thing for me to say to myself, okay, every Wednesday from 1 to 4, I'm going to do XYZ. Whereas having a checklist, which Dr. Beck gave me, being like, okay, so by Wednesday, all of the clicker questions for next week need to be up. That's a little bit different. And I think that that's something that professors that are going to be working with TAs in the future, those kinds of structures are not only helpful to students, but also helpful to TAs.
Something I've been thinking about a lot because the lack of structure was really hard for me in grad school. In terms of writing my thesis, I had a really hard time getting things done. And eventually had to ask my advisor, like, can I meet with you every week just so that I have like something that is putting the fear of God in me a little bit? And so I think I have been acutely aware of students who might need some motivation and structure as well, because that was hard for me in grad school. And yeah, I thought my students loved the checklists. And I think and some of my students too, because I told them, I was like, you know, deadlines are made up at this point. Just, you know, get things in when you can get them in.
Right.
But the students that looked like were starting to slip and to not be showing up and not be turning things in, you know, being able, just kind of giving them a little nudge of like, hey, just check in. Nothing's like late or overdue. I just wanted to know how you're doing with stuff. Because I think that is one of the things that not having the structure that we all have about, you know, you go from this class to that class to this. And now that days of the week don't mean anything anymore, I think that, yeah, that having structure and accountability is something that's been hard for everyone. And so, you know, providing that for graduate students and undergraduate students and everyone is a really helpful thing to do.
So Joanne, what about you? What wisdom do you have to share with us?
I mean, like we've been talking about, it is really difficult to plan for the fall semester until the university makes some final decisions about certain things. Fortunately, UT has at least decided that classes over 100 students will be administered online. So at least you instructors with large enrollment classes can start to plan for something fully online. And then we'll figure out what's going to happen with smaller enrollment courses. The best advice I could give right now is that you should, to some extent, plan to do a little bit of both. And by that, I mean, don't plan two different classes. That's just too much work. But plan to have some of your classes be, especially if it's a small enrollment class, like I have a small Greek language class in the fall. But one of the things that everyone has been saying at the end of this semester was that 3 hours of, you know, Zoom for a class is just too much. And everybody was, you know, there were articles they were writing about Zoom exhaustion and things like that. So, and now there's a lot of things being written about creating a high flex course, right? Which means hybrid flexible. And in a way, I think that might be the best approach. So you kind of plan your course as if it's a hybrid, as if you're going to have a certain amount of time in a face-to-face classroom and a certain amount of content that you're going to deliver online, right? So for example, for a language course, I would have maybe 2 days in class and then develop 1 day of online content for them to do. So then if we go to a fully online model, I can do my 2 face-to-face class days over Zoom and then, you know, have 1 hour of content that I've already created over the summer for students to work with online. And there's various different types of, you know, collaborative ways that we get students to, you know, contribute to a group translation or especially in language classes to parse nouns and parse verbs and things like that. But I would also even consider doing the same thing with my large enrollment classes, but I would probably switch it there. I would probably do maybe 1 hour of a Zoom where students, and I probably maybe not do it as a lecture, but like a 1 hour, maybe even required review session of material for the week. And then 2 hours of built content for the other 3 hours of coursework. And so, and this way, planning that, you don't feel like you're wasting, as an instructor, you don't feel like you're wasting your time building two different classes, right? But you're building one hybrid class. And then once the university figures out what the plan is for fall, then the adjustments you'll have to make will be pretty minor. So that would be my advice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's smart. That's the word I was looking. I was gonna say clever, and then my brain just got stuck in this loop about like you were saying before, about like, is clever crafty in a good way?
Is it wily? Is it?
Yeah, but I do feel like we are being required to be very Odyssean, right? Very, very like polytropo, and we have to like be able to change course on a dime, which I don't nimble exactly, which I don't love. I have to say, I'm not feeling nimble.
Well, and I think, I mean, a lot of the skills that are useful and required right now are just not the things that academia has trained us for and selected for, right? Like that has not been the ability to sit in a library and do research and think deep thoughts is what we have generally selected for in academia, and not the ability to turn on a dime when unexpected things come at you. I wouldn't say that anyone thinks that's the traditional thing academics are really good at. And so I think, you know, it is requiring us to develop new things that are not, it's not what we're used to doing, and it's not necessarily what we're good at. It's a weird time. Yeah.
But then, you know, you just made me think, like, you know, Zoe's teaching statement for the job market is going to be amazing, because you will be able to address, right? Like we're basically like our, you know, through no fault of our own, are going to have a generation of graduate students who have this very unique experience, which we hope that none of, like, you know, future cohorts will have to deal with. But, you know, this set of students will have much more kind of adaptable, like, you know, skills, and they'll, you know, I mean, you, right? We'll hopefully be able to leverage it in much more, like, effective ways. Like, we all can fall back on, like, well, you know, we weren't trained this way, but, you know, you won't, right? And that's an advantage. So it's, you know, I do hope that, like, once we're 2 or 3 years out and things are back to normal and there's a vaccine and we're all, like, back to a new normal, that we will be able to kind of start making lemonade out of this crazy situation, and having a generation of students who is much more comfortable with all of these online platforms and is much more comfortable with remote teaching and kind of, you know, researching in difficult situations. I mean, I see a lot of possibility for, like, much more inclusive teaching and much more inclusive research practices and stuff like that. But
I will say, I mean, this whole experience of, you know, becoming a pandemic pedagogy, which is, like, you know, like Joanne has said, completely different from online pedagogy, has really changed the way that I view assessing student learning. But something that's been really valuable for our Intro to Myth class has been doing more metacognitive assignments and creative assignments to assess student learning, which is very different from our typical, you know, here's a multiple choice exam, now take that and see how many facts about myth can you regurgitate at me. And it's been a really valuable experience. Like, the students got more out of that form of assessment. Like, they've said that in their reflections, saying this was a very, you know, a much more meaningful way of getting in touch with everything that I've learned from this semester. And like Amy was saying with her students, we've gotten some amazing creative products out of it. We had a student who wrote an 11-page Greek tragedy, just wrote one as his creative assignment. And it's incredible. I mean, it's both a parody of tragedy, but also, like, the chorus is made up of sheep. And so the choral sections are just baaing in the background. It's impeccable. Like, Dr. Beck and I want to do a dramatic staging of this play in Zoom because it's so good. So there's, I mean, that's really changed the way that I have viewed assessments. And I, cause I come from like an academic family. So I was raised in this like very strict, you know, we give tests and tests are the way we do it. And both my stepdad and my dad are STEM professors. And so they come from a very much more, I think, strict and formalized environment. Whereas, you know, looking forward to classes that I get to design, Joanna has seen in my submissions for our pedagogy seminar, like I'm very much going to be trying to incorporate these metacognitive reflections and creative projects or things that encourage student interaction with the materials on in a very different way. Which has its own challenges. It's, again, a lot more labor intensive in terms of grading. And something we ran into is assuring students that, you know, this isn't an art class. I don't care if you draw stick figures, like that's fine. But finding ways to encourage and facilitate student creativity in a non-judgmental way.
And I think, because that's something that I've been, and here, Jesuit Ignatian pedagogy is really big on reflection anyway. Mm. So that's something that's very much like there's a lot of structural stuff to support kind of reflective metacognitive work here. But I think those are both directions that I've for the past couple of years been heading in with, you know, I have students do creative translation assignments and things. And it feels like because of all of this, like, well, and a lot of us have kind of stripped down to like, what is actually important and, you know, in our lives in general. I mean, there's a lot of things that we're like, I don't know why we were all doing that thing, that, you know, wearing real pants. Do we have to go back to wearing real pants ever again? But I think in terms of teaching, it has forced us to kind of distill like, okay, you know, we lost a week of class and I had to be more selective about what we did. And I think it's forced us all to think, like, what are the really important things, right? What are the things that I most want my students to get out of this class? And students have found cool ways to do things in the midst of this. And I think we can take those things without all of the horrible stuff that caused it. But we can take a lot of the things that we've learned in terms of, and even, like, some of the most useful classes in terms of me developing as a teacher were classes that were not well designed. As a TA, you know, GSI, I TA'd for some classes that it was not a good environment to be teaching in. It was not well designed. Yeah. The students, you know, and I think I thought a lot more about teaching because of the challenges I was facing those semesters. And so I think in some ways, I think we are all thinking a lot more about teaching, about learning, about what the essential stuff is. And sort of as a silver lining maybe to take away from this horrible situation we're all in is that I think maybe our teaching will be better out on the other side because of the different ways we've had to think about how can we use online stuff? How can we think about equity? How can we think about access? Because we've been having to really be more cognizant of that in terms of, do our students have internet access? But once we start thinking about equity and access, maybe we should do that all the time in all of our classes.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, I think there are some silver linings to a bad situation in terms of creative, like developing and improving pedagogy.
As you were talking, I was thinking that it could be an interesting way think about language classes, which has been the big obstacle for a lot of us. How do you teach, especially beginners and intermediate language classes online? And a lot of what we're talking about is just a pedagogical application of translation theory, right? How do you literally, right, transform a text so it can perform its function in a new environment? And, you know, we've kind of as a field are trying to move away from the like henpecking approach to like reading Latin and Greek, but then, you know, maybe it is more about leaning into people's creativity and kind of thinking about, you know, either in like Duolingo ways or in a just kind of just like really more creative ways. Like, how do I teach syntax and morphology in these environments when I can't like sit down with a student and like figure out whether they know all the uses of the ablative, and I just need to kind of like figure out whether they understand what the sentence is and what it wants to do. And that could be an interesting way forward, right? In my daughter's Spanish class in daycare, right, they're 3-year-olds, but they do a lot of dancing, and I always kind of was like, yeah, that's not how you learn a language. But now I'm thinking maybe I should talk to Maestro Agar after this is all over and figure out how you like dance your way to Spanish. Maybe we can like dance our way to Latin.
But yeah, I think one of the positives that comes out of it is really like leaning into creativity and play and reigniting the pleasure, right, of learning, which I think is a thing that we've all missed in this pandemic teaching, which has just not been fun, right? It's kind of, so yeah, so, you know, that's a hopeful note to end on, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you all for, you know, sharing of your time. Is there anything that any of you wants to make sure is out there? Is there anything you want to add? Because we can, you know, Colton can do his magic. So if there's anything you feel like you've forgotten or...
Maybe just, I would like to encourage everyone to be kind to themselves as we're going through this, because I know a lot of people are, this is hard. And, you know, it would be nice for everyone to give themselves a little bit of grace and compassion, because yeah. I know, you know, this is not, life is normal. And a lot of people are under a lot of stress, people, you know, teachers and students and everybody. So as we embark on doing all of this over the summer, I think, you know, be kind and compassionate to yourselves, because this is tough.
And we should probably also say that it's summertime, and if you haven't yet planned to take an actual break.
Yeah, take an actual break. Like, yes. Set an away thing that I'm not answering my email, sorry guys.
Yeah. And even if you're just staring at your wall, then do it proudly and freely.
Enjoy staring at that wall.
Yeah, binge wall.
Don't feel guilty that you're staring at the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Take a real break, and also like make time over the summer to do your thing, like your research, your, you know, whatever it is that you're going to get reevaluated on next year. Like,
gotta finally write that master's thesis.
Yeah, write that master's thesis. You know, just because this is a weird summer doesn't mean that our usual responsibilities go away. And for a lot of us, research is where we like either recharge or kind of, I don't know, reset our panic button, because we're like, yes, I have done my own work. I can now, you know, refill your own cup in whatever way that works for you. And I'm looking at Zoe because I know she's not.
Huh?
Zoe, sorry. Refill your cup.
My internet keeps cutting in and out.
Oh, okay.
I don't have any more coffee, but I will refill it with coffee later.
Yes. But
I'm roommates with one of the other PhD students at UT, and we aggressively force each other to take time off.
Good. Sam is a good woman. You are lucky to have her.
Yes, she's very tolerant.
Yes. Well, she's lucky to have you. So.
Well. Yes, the bully and the memes. So I bring essential parts to our department.
One of my favorite things about our department is that we've started having these like pairs of students who like are basically like grad school married, right? And they live together, and they're like, you all have the same class together. So like Grace and Anna and you and Sam and yeah, it's great. And I, you know, I really enjoy that.
Haley and David.
Haley and David, wow. Who are a couple.
I know.
Yes.
Literally and legally married.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing beat the Theophilus and Coylan, but situation.
No,
but,
I mean, it's a very special relationship that they have.
But that will be a separate episode. But yeah, I do enjoy that about you guys, that you travel and...
Impacts.
Yes.
We're more threatening than
the buddy system. You take a friend.
Yeah.
Roving herds of grad students.
Exactly. And you'd better pick your buddy soon, Sam.
I know.
Yeah. Well, one of the other people going to mission again, I actually knew in high school, so he and I are going together our first year.
Cool.
Yeah. Having a grad school buddy is important.
Yeah, we don't know each other well, but.
But you will.
Competed against each other in Cartagena.
Yeah. You get real close in your first year in grad school, going through survey courses together. You will.
Yeah. It's a thing. Yeah. And then you might never talk to each other again. Like, because first year friendships are like, they can be a weird thing.
Yes.
Sorry, Amy, what were you saying? I totally cut you off.
Oh, just there is something to be said for shared suffering does bring people closer together. True. But grad school, first year of grad school, there's a lot of like you know, the classes are hard and you are reading a lot of stuff and you get very close to the people that like are going through that with you. You become a band of brothers and sisters and things after.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one day you're all like drunk in an SES being like, remember the time we stayed up and read like 3 books of the Odyssey? And yeah. Ours is that we all stayed up and did a pros comp assignment for Celia Schultz. and we all did it. And then at the end of the night, we were exhausted, so we went to Starbucks. But the classics library had this like big desk and we had like covered it in shit, like books and dictionaries and like snacks and whatnot. And we were like, hey, well, we'll leave it. We'll go get a coffee and we'll come back. And when we came back, our librarian had opened the library and she gave us, like, she was a formidable Italian lady and she gave us a talking to. But because she loved us really, we didn't actually get in trouble. But that was our bonding moment.
Delightful.
The classics librarian at UT, Sheila Winchester, has, I love her. I would die for her. But my very first day as a graduate student at UT, and we took our big tour and we went into the library and we had tacos because, of course, we have breakfast tacos. And I had half of one. And I didn't want to put it away. I wanted to eat it, but I knew I shouldn't have food in the library, so I shoved the entire thing in my mouth and then showed up in the classics library. And Sheila was like, are you eating in my library? And I was like, it's all in my mouth. It's not out of the books.
She has definitely seen me, eating in the reference section.
Ever since then. I mean, like, every so often she'd be like, so have you had any tacos recently? Or if I'll have like a cup of coffee in one of the little cubicles, and she'll be like, those better not be library books that you've got there on that desk with you. I'm like, they're not, I promise. They're mine. This has been a classics librarian appreciation.
Yeah, classic librarian. Now I'm torn about whether, okay, Colton, we will discuss whether to keep them.
Keep my shame about my breakfast taco.
No, this is like one of the best breakfast taco stories I have heard.
So Austin was the first place that I ever had a breakfast taco. And I am a huge fan of breakfast Mexican food, but I've never been anywhere. Like breakfast burritos, sure.
Yeah.
I had never been anywhere that had breakfast tacos until I was in Austin visiting some friends.
We don't actually get burritos here so much, and I do miss a good burrito. Yeah. So
live places where you can get burritos but not tacos. The breakfast tacos was just an exceptional. It was nice to see my friends that I was visiting, but also like, oh my god, tacos.
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna step off. Thank you guys all so much. It was really great.
Thank you. This was so fun.
Yeah, this was really fun. Thanks for inviting me, guys.
Oh, thank you for coming. Yeah,
I actually got to run too.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, I was supposed to be watching Ovid and the Art of Love about 90 minutes. At first, I thought this was Saturday, which is when I have Coptic group at 11, and we were supposed to be online, like watching Ovid. I mean, the movie's not going anywhere. I'm streaming it on Amazon. I can stream it on Amazon anytime I get in front of my.
I was like very surprised when I saw Corbin Bleu.
I am very excited about it. It got I've heard very good things, and I'm just going to have to ignore everyone's tweets about it and watch it myself and then have opinions. So but so it was wonderful to chat with you all though, and
enjoy your holiday weekend.
Stay safe. Yeah, yeah. Enjoy the weekends, guys.
And yeah, we'll see you all soon, hopefully.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.